Hello everyone, welcome back to Even More Eyes 2. Probably what might be the last episode of this year in review. By the way, our year begins in February, in case you didn't notice, because we're just edgy like that. So today we're going to be doing a snippet slideshow quick review of what we may call the best of Ghibli. And the best of Ghibli is entirely our opinion. Mm-hmm. You can fight us on that. But mostly in honor of Ghibli's latest release, we started feeling nostalgic and decided to take a deep dive back into quintessential Ghibs and Japan's Disney, really. Even though, of course, like, Disney could never do half the stuff that Ghibli does. So we're going to be reviewing four picks that we've picked from four different eras of Ghibli. And we're going to jump right into it. So as this is a nostalgia review, we're going to do the usual, which is we begin with what we remember about it and then what we are doing now. So what do you remember about early Ghibs, James, my dear?
So My Neighbor Totoro, obviously this is not the first film that I watched. It came out in 1988, which is the year before I was born. This one wasn't on my radar at all. I remember seeing the logo and thinking, oh, what's that cute thing? Not realising, obviously, there was a film behind it. And I remember watching it and found it incredibly charming, but also quite challenging as a film, just simply because I wasn't really sure about various elements. So, because one thing I would say, I didn't watch it with the eyes of a child. I would think I was at least in my 20s. So my take on it back then was a bit more psychological. I thought this was about two young children. They'd had to move out of the city. They had to go to a place that was very isolated, very different to where they come from. And obviously in the background of the film is this sick parent. And so what I thought is that Totoro and the little Totoros, whatever they are, were ways for these two children to cope with this mixture of trauma, being parent that wasn't well, and the other, if you like, trauma, though I don't ever necessarily want to use that word, of moving to somewhere completely different. And of course them being in an environment that had a sense of mystery but also had this sense of isolation. And Totoro comes as a presence that is incredibly comforting to the children, to both of them, to Mei and to Satsuki. And that was my reading of the film at the time, which obviously the more I've read and the more I've seen of Miyazaki's films, I've realised is probably less what they were going for. I think the last thing I'll say about it is that even though it is a very charming film, there are little moments in the film which you're a bit like, is there something a bit more disturbing going on here? I mean, the scene where Mei sort of lies on Totoro in this great big gaping mouth. And obviously having seen a few Ghibli films before this, where there was a very active threat, I was like, oh God, what is this? What's really happening here? So, but fortunately it doesn't play out that way. So that's what I remembered about Totoro the first time I saw it.
For me, Totoro, when I first saw it, I can't even remember what I was thinking. I probably think I was half asleep because it felt like a weird fever dream of a film, especially when, like, the cat bus shows up. I'm just like, what the fuck am I looking at? But at the same time, I felt it had a sense of whimsy, and there was something somewhat Disney-esque about its premise, you know, like the missing mother, which is a Disney thing, and the two children in this almost countryside. There's a sort of romanticism that comes with that idea of life being simpler in the countryside. And I remember just looking at it and thinking, okay, this looks kind of chill. The children are probably just trying to explore and make sense of this new world and things like that. The part about the mother honestly did not register as much to me in terms of its impact on the plot, mostly because, again, she was part of the way a lot, even though, of course, it was a central point of conflict for the two girls. But it just felt, oh, it's this kid's going on some sort of Famous Five-esque adventure where they find a forest creature and make friends with the forest creature and so on. And much like you, when I first saw Totoro was actually after I'd seen other Ghibli films. So I think I maybe translated it from the same lens from which I watched something like Ponyo on the Cliff, where there's just this fantastical supernatural element that coexists with everyday life. And I just saw it as, oh, this is just early Miyazaki's take on people being able to access and live in conjunction or within some sort of harmony with the supernatural. Mm. So it also, because it's, you know, like my neighbor, Totoro, just gives this sense of, oh, we just live in close proximity to something that is meant to be essentially like this massive supernatural force or king of the forest, really. So that was my take on it. I mean, what is ironic is that my feeling about Totoro now is a lot closer to what you literally just said. I saw it more as like, the way the story is written is almost be read from the perspective of like a psychological drama of this is an object of almost coping for these two kids who are trying to navigate a world that is essentially terrifying. You are reckoning with things like your mom not being home again, like she could literally die, but also trying to be like strong in a sense while not being strong because they are literally kids. I think the older child is what, 9 or 10, if that. So you have these two little girls who are trying to be strong. Dad is off on the side and he's very busy trying to be like a single parent of two little girls. And these girls are mostly left to their own devices in a new environment. So obviously there's a lot that might be going on in terms of sources of anxieties and worries and fears for these two girls. And so we can almost see Totoro and all the things that they believe about Totoro as a sort of shared delusion or like a folie à deux, where the two of them are going mad together in their conjoined belief in an imaginary friend. So yeah, that's how I started reading it now. But I feel like that also may have been intentional in the way the story was written and conveyed. Is, oh, this is a thing that only little children can see. And you could always chalk it down to it's because children still have the imagination to see it. Yes, but you could also read it the other way, that children still have the innocence and purity to be able to access the spiritual realm with such ease. So it's in between where you can read it in two ways. And there's a part of me that thinks that maybe that's was intentional by the creators of the story, because it does give room for that interpretation. I've done like a speed through into how I feel about the movie now, so I'll pass the mic.
I almost feel a bit tired of the film just because in the last year, I think I've watched it about three times. And then recently, the RSC had done a production of the film, which is quite an incredible feat for the stage, I have to be honest. And if you have an opportunity, it would say, not I'm doing some plugging here for the RSC, but if you do have an opportunity to go and see it, then I would recommend it, especially if you're a fan of the film. I think watching it now and knowing a little bit more, because Ghibli was a bit of a gateway to elements of Japanese culture, mainly, not so much of history, but mainly of culture, especially some of the more, I guess, mystical or religious elements in the society. So, for example, once I'd started to, you know, learn a bit more about a particular belief called animism, which is the idea that, you know, I guess souls or spirits or whatever occupy objects that otherwise might just be seen to be a lump of wood or whatever, or a tree. And I think that particular idea is laced throughout the film, because Totoro is a manifestation of the forest. The cat bus, as weird as it might be, is also a manifestation of the air, the forest as well. And I think that when I've rewatched it now with those ideas in mind, I think it's very much about these city dwellers, if you like, coming into contact with this bigger natural force. And I think the father, even though, yes, I think stuff about the family still holds very true. It's a family that is displaced, not just merely in terms of where they've gone to, but also the dynamics in the family. The mother, who still stereotypically is seen as the caregiver, the domestic, the father is having to do that. And of course, you know, as we see, he makes a bit of a hash of it in some ways. He's quite good in other ways. But I think for the children, it's their first encounter with this, because the father introduces them to the tree. There's a lot about the history of the area, the statues and so on. And of course, how as they go through the film, they slowly embrace this, whether that there's a statue and they ask to go underneath the house of the statue. You see other moments where obviously they're embracing growing things in the garden and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that for me now, funny enough, it's almost like we've crossed each other, really. That for me has come through a lot stronger. And I think when we start to get a wider picture of the Ghibli Miyazaki canon, there's a lot there about environmentalism and the natural world human beings,
which we will get to in the next one. in many ways. What is kind of interesting is that we've both ended up having both readings of the film.
Yes, yeah.
Which, for me, on some level is telling to the realm of interpretations that are possible and seem reasonable to make. Because I do also understand the environmentalism, animism aspect of it. I think that cuts through a lot of Ghibli. It's really rare to find a Ghibli film that doesn't have some sort of conversation about the interaction of the real and the unreal, or what we might consider to be the supernatural or the metaphysical,
yes,
or the forces of nature that shape the world around us, and also people's interactions with that, whether that is in a more very pacified, positive, nuanced, exploratory way, as we see in something like My Neighbor Totoro, or in the more negative, horrible, exploitative way that we are going to see in the next film that we're going to talk about, which is Princess Mononoke, which came from Ghibli's 1990s. Nostalgically, what I remember about this film was, damn, she ate. Like, that's basically the summary of the feeling that I remember from the film. I'm just like, strong female protagonist for the win. Because it was kind of incredible to see a film where, you know, you have a strong female protagonist, a strong female antagonist, and you have men alongside them, in a sense, who are also contributing to the plot in their own ways, but also not really overshadowing the women. And that was the first thing I thought about, but then there was also that really, really strong, very disturbing sense of how grotesque some of the scenes were, and, you know, the spirits and the demons and things like that. I found Mononoke very disturbing the first time I watched it. I was just, babes, what the fuck is going on? And Ghibli is known for its pretty, but Mononoke was Ghibli showing us that they could do ugly. They could do ugly very well. Like, some scenes were, like, genuinely terrifying, and even the way the film begins, a hog demon coming out and infesting everything, yes, that looks like it's covered in blood maggot. I was just like, this is a cold open, babes. Like, like I barely had 5 minutes to breathe into this film. That was how I felt about it the first time.
Yeah, so I think that it's quite funny, really. You were talking about how grotesque and violent it was. I don't really think I noticed that much when I watched it the first time. I don't
really?
Know what that means. Yeah, I know. It's so bizarre, which we'll get on to when we talk about our reflections now. But I actually think I found myself very overwhelmed by the film. It was very different to some of the Studio Ghibli films or Miyazaki films that I'd seen previous to this. As you talked about, there was this basically fantasy world, mythological world, and usually the films that I'd seen prior were always about the interaction between human beings in, you know, a historical reality, if you like, or in the real world, as opposed to interacting with the supernatural element or going into a supernatural world. And I just was completely swept away by it. I just thought it was extremely epic in its scope, in the number of characters, the locations they visited, incredibly immersive, to the point where I was, once again, like with Totoro, I was struggling to work out all of its elements. What's this mean and what's that mean and so on. So that was my initial impression of Mononoke, but it quickly became a favourite of mine.
So returning to how we feel about it now, I would say it's so weird because I feel like we keep on doing a crossover thing. because when I watch Mononoke now, I got a lot of those same feelings because, again, I'm watching this now after like a lifetime of watching so much about Ghibli and how it's always a case of, oh, there is a contemporary-ish world and people are interacting with this element that is somewhat unusual or spiritual or different about that world. And that's a really common format for a lot of Ghibli films. Not all of them. For instance, something like Nausicaa or The Valley of the Wind is set in a very different hive fantasy scape, or something like The Castle in the Sky is kind of similarish in terms of the world has very clear fantastical elements that are part of the everyday. And I think Mononoke has that going on as well, where, oh, people expect what a demon is or what like a spirit is or something. It's not you are encountering something that you do not know about. It's more like, okay, this is like almost common knowledge that there are forest spirits out there and that there are demons and there are clans of people who live in very different ways and stuff like that. While at the same time, it does have a lot of elements of a sort of historical fantasy where it's set in a particular feudalish era. I think a lot of fantasy plot lines tend to be set in an era where people can ride on horses.
Yes, but, yeah.
But of setting that sort of era where there's like an expansion by, or like a shogun or something. Mm-hmm. And it sort of involves also removing the spiritual element as something that gets in the way of its expansion or something like that, because they're calling for the head of the forest's spirit. And in this one, this is where Miyazaki's very environmentalist element really, really comes forward, because you can see this massive difference even in just the setting and the outlay. And I know this might be an aesthetic comparison, but the way things look like in the forest, where there's this, you know, richness and lushness, and like there are forest spirits that are just freely moving wherever they please and things like that.
Yes, yeah.
And then that's completely different from this city and town that has built itself around an ironwork, and they're making guns and weapons of war and things like that, while also alluding to other more difficult things that have befallen the people there. For instance, a lot of the women who are there used to be sex workers, yes, who are now like getting a new lease on life. So they have freedom within this new confine, but there is a tale of ongoing exploitation in some forms. These women were exploited, but now they are the part of the people who are exploiting the forest, and there is the other people who are trying to expand into new territory. And so it's just like this never-ending battle from people on all sides of the fight, I guess. And I think that was really powerful to reckon with as an ongoing thread through the entire story from the very beginning.
Yes.
And then you have this main protagonist. He is almost, despite being a warrior in the very real sense, and of course, every time he had one of those moments when he literally shot someone's head off with like a bow and arrow, which always made me scream a bit. Despite being a warrior and like a lethal one, it's kind of interesting that this character is more like a pacifist, almost of sorts. He's the one who's trying to get everyone to get along, and you know, it's a very interesting interplay of those elements of war and peace, and like, you know, trying to create peace in the middle of conflict, and people who have justified reasons to hate each other. For instance, Princess Mononoke herself is out for blood when it comes to this lady who runs this town, but like she also has her thing that's against the spirit. And then there's this guy who is walking on stilts, more or less, that has his own agenda, and there's this wild mix of concerns that everyone has and what they think is a justified thing to do based on their concerns, and it's all at odds. That's actually, for me, gave a sense of epicness to the plot, because it throws you into the middle of this fray, everyone with different ideas of what they think needs to be done.
Yes.
And all these things are at war with each other, and all these things are contributing towards a conflict, and there's animosity and enmity on different sides. And, you know, these ones want the humans dead, and the humans want the forest spirits dead, and the humans want these other humans dead. And it's just all of that is happening for 2 hours. So that's what I got from Mononoke this time. It was a very epic, that was a tale of war and hatred in the human condition, but also it had that environmentalist element of like the exploitation of the environment and how that would inevitably backfire because we are supposed to live in harmony with the environment stuff like that. So those were the vibes, really. And I'll pass mic now.
See, the thing that stood out to me, probably more watching it recently, though it should have occurred to me before then, was just how grim and graphic this particular film is compared to the wider Ghibli filmography or Miyazaki's other films. It really does not hold back, as you said, you know, when he's literally popping heads off with arrows. You have the thing at the end where they've clearly, you know, skinned the boars and they're wearing the dead boars.
Exactly,
skins.
They're wearing the hides.
You know, it doesn't hold back on all the bile and the sick and the blood. I was so shocked, but I should have noticed this because I remember playing this film when I worked in a school. We did an international film festival type thing.
And you played this
and
one?
We played this one, and I remember all the kids just going, when I think it's Ashitaka took off the first guy's head, and I was suddenly like, oh, hang on a minute. So, yeah, I think that element of the film, just because in other works, from what I can remember, there is a sense of holding back. There isn't as it isn't as grisly as this film. That's something that slightly shocked me watching it again. I think picking up on what you said as well about people having their own agendas or looking at things from their own perspectives and having their own various justifications, the thing that did occur to me was just how much more complex each of the characters are in this film. And also underneath some very clear oppositions between the natural world and the human world is that suggestion that things are a bit more complicated. So one thing I noticed about Mononoke herself was obviously she is a human being raised by wolf spirits. Yeah. And the question keeps coming back, either from Ashitaka or from the Lord of the Pigs, and they're raising this human. And I think it subtly suggests that humans are part of the natural world, part of the spiritual world, and also the other way round as well. And so, like you said, obviously Miyazaki is really trying to press this point in a very unambiguous way about the relationship between the natural world and the human world. The villain, like you said, she's not just a straight out villain. She has built this place. The women have come from brothels. They play an integral role in the society as well. There's obviously these little scenes where the women are basically taking the mick out of the men.
Yeah.
And it's not as simple as this is just some cruel society. And I think it built a lot upon what Nausicaa, his earlier film, I think a lot of those themes were there, but doesn't quite hammer it home as it does here. There is a lot of fighting between the different factions, but I don't know, for me it seemed that the people who lived in the Valley of the Wind were just, you know, they're trying to mind their own business, do their own thing, and everyone else was having these conflicts, where in Mononoke it seems that Iron Town is a bit more complicated in how those people came to be there and what their agendas are and so on. It's still my favourite. It's still an absolutely stunning film in terms of its depictions of both the grotesque and the beautiful. The scenes where you have the forest spirit appearing. I like also just that Ashitaka, yes, he's a prince, and there's that classic trope of him going off to solve a problem, to try and work out what's going on in the world, but he's also affected by it as well. There is a real sense of jeopardy. Yeah. The thing that makes him powerful is actually the thing that is killing him, which of course is a byproduct of the way in which human beings have corrupted the natural world. I have to admit, watching it recently, I was quite blown away just how good it is.
Yeah, exactly. I was expecting that it would be amazing, but I just forgot just how many little details are thrown in there. Like, the final thing I would say about it is there's this little element that I thought was very interesting about the relationship between Ashitaka and Princess Mononoke, right? Because it's basically a prince meets a princess.
Yes.
But the way their relationship is played out is we are not sure if it's a romantic one or if it's a filial one.
Yes, yeah.
Right? Because it could be almost like he sees her like a younger sister, the way he saw his younger sister that he left back home.
Yeah, yeah.
The little thing that he gives to her, isn't that what his sister gave to him?
It is, and I had a sort of joke about that when I watched it through recently, and she says, oh, don't forget me, and then the film gets her.
but like
you said, there is that callback with the little crystal knife.
With little crystal flints thing, you know, because like when I saw that, I'm not sure what this symbolizes. Like, are you giving this to her as a gift because it's a statement of the of love that you have for your sibling who gave this to you? Or, okay, this is a precious thing for which I'm giving this to you so that you don't forget me, you know? So I couldn't tell what that was symbolizing because that thing had transferred hands twice.
Yes, and
Ghibli, obviously, by the end of the movie, doesn't really advance their relationship besides the interaction that they've had within the context of that film, which is you go back to the forest, I go back and help rebuild the people. And, you know, that's kind of where it ends.
Yeah.
The one thing that does get resolved by the end is that he does get healed by the forest spirits, even though that was a really long, long-winded way to get there. it is kind of fascinating how many turns the film takes and how layered and complex and nuanced the characters are, and especially that idea of the integration of, you know, being adopted by the supernatural in a sense. And that's the connecting thread that takes us to our next epic, right? Which is Spirited Away. Now, everyone and their grandmother at this point knows what this film is. Like, it's a... Spirited Away is the Miyazaki movie, as much as My Neighbor Totoro is used as the logo. Like, every time say Ghibli, everyone's, oh, Spirited Away. And I think it won how many, like, Oscars and shit. That isn't even surprising because the film is insane in its scope. I'm going to go back into a nostalgia first because, like most people, Spirited Away was, for me, actually my first introduction to Miyazaki. Okay, and then after I saw Spirited Away, shortly after that, I think I saw Ponyo on the Cliff, and I started getting a sense of what Miyazaki was about in terms of its integration of the spiritual elements with, like, the everyday.
Yeah.
But the first time I watched, I was just like, this is wild, because what I would say was central to my original experience of this film was just the culture shock.
Yes,
because your idea of a fantasy kids film is Disney, and then you watch one where a dragon is bleeding on the floor, you're just like, oh, Disney could never. Or like, or like, basically how the film starts, where she just has to watch that very disturbing scene of her parents turning into pigs. It draws you in so sharply and so starkly, and then you have the bathhouse scene with the mud, and it's, there were just all those little elements that just made the film hit very different in terms of what it was willing to depict and the scale of what the spiritual world looked, in terms of how almost apathetic it was towards humans, but also had its own way of running. And I felt just the main character drawn into this world that I did not understand anything about, and I could almost feel the feelings of the confusion, the shock, and from scene to scene. And that's how I felt the first time I watched it. I don't know if you had a similar experience.
Oh yeah, completely. And like yourself, and I guess it's something we've been alluding to, this was also my gateway into Ghibli, the very first Miyazaki film I watched. And I think, like you said, it was because suddenly people were mentioning this film, talking about this film. I was trying to think back, and it's not like I was unfamiliar with anime at this point. Probably like yourself, you know, I'd seen Pokemon, Gundam Wing, Dragon Ball Z, Sailor Moon, but yet the idea of something completely separate from those franchises in a feature film, probably seen as quite unusual and incredible. Of course, you know, there had been before, and probably one day we'll podcast on Akira and some of the big anime films. I think exactly like yourself, it was just how unusual this film was, both in terms of not following really much of a conventional structure. It is that kind of Disney model that you would go into a world that was highly unusual with its creatures, the whole dynamics between the servants of this tower and the patrons, what was and who was human and who wasn't, when you had characters that, you know, looked like humans but weren't actually humans. Obviously, it was just bowled over by the animation of it. Just some of the scenes are just so striking. It was a mixture of, like you said, very disturbing, and also at the same time being extremely charming as well. The music was just, I still listen to the soundtrack. It's really sweeping and has a real twinkle and a real quality to it. The first time I watched it, there was a lot that just I hadn't really taken in. And it almost seemed it was rounded up extremely quickly. It's a film that has an enormous amount of world building at the beginning. At that time, I didn't really understand what this story had really been about. The nearest thing I could think of it, really, if I was trying to look for a touchstone or a reference, was probably Alice in Wonderland. You know, something about a young girl who falls into this world and is sort of swept up by its mixture of lunacy and magic and so on. I think subsequent watches have clarified it a little bit more for me. That's what I can remember. And yeah, it is, like you said, you're absolutely right, that the minute the name Ghibli gets mentioned, or Miyazaki gets mentioned, you can just see Chihiro in a little red costume.
Yeah.
You think of No Face. So
Exactly. Watching it now, I mean, I think the one thing that did come across, and it's interesting that it comes across in its chronology as well, is that idea of what love means between two creatures from very different places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Chihiro obviously loves the dragon. But then what does that mean? And I think that's what I would focus on for Spirited Away, really, because of course there's the world, which is fantastic. Honestly, the animation for this film was incredible, just how many things they had to animate in any given scene. I think what was beautiful about it was the film begins with Chihiro being this displaced element that is clearly unwanted because she's a human in the spirit world and almost has to earn her keep. And the result of that incredible spiritual world stuff going on when Chihiro first comes in and she's sort of like trying to navigate this mess with one objective and one objective only, which is just to free her parents because her parents are pigs and they're like stuck here. And then also to stop them from, I don't know, being killed and eaten. So there is like a real sense of urgency behind what she's doing. But I think somewhere in the middle of the film, her priority starts to shift just a little bit. And then instead of just being out to do something for herself, there's a sense of there is something more that I could do here. There's some other way I could help. And then the way she tries to help Haku when he's wounded and reconciles the two witch sisters. And there is some sense that her presence here has gone from being unwanted to being valuable. And that was the big turn of the film to me. But then also by the end of it, there is this question around what love means between two entities from very different places whose lives actually do not really intersect. And it was something that I picked up from in like Princess Mononoke, where obviously the princess herself lives in an entirely different world with the wolf tribe spirits. And so that is her world, whether we like it or not. She might be human in how she looks, but she's not from the human world. And then this person from the human world comes in and they have this interaction that is seen as a loving one. But then what does that mean for them moving forward? And I think a similar thing happens here as well, where obviously Chihiro and Haku, the love is defined in an entirely different way from the romanticism that we're used to seeing. And I thought that that was interesting to focus on this time, because at the end of the day, love is at risk of sounding very cliche and cheesy. Love brings everything back together in a sense, or like love is this healing force that has helped with so many things, including reconciliation and sacrifice and all of that that is being done on both sides. Spirited Away is a weird of love story to me now. That's how I mentally see it. And that was my main takeaway this time after watching it, because I've watched it so many times before. And I think on some level, I was trying to think, okay, what has really changed now that I'm seeing it again as an older person? Like when I was younger, I watched it so many times because my baby cousin loved Spirited Away. I mean, she was really young at the time. She could watch that film like 5 times in the same day. But now I was just thinking, okay, what stands out to me, especially looking at it from a grown-up lens and also looking at it in light of the rest of the Miyazaki Ghibli canon that we've been looking at?
See, I think for me, what stood out more this time was very much about a young girl who, in the real world, you see at the very beginning of the film, she's quite dependent, stroppy. She doesn't really understand why things are happening. She doesn't like the things that are happening to her. Very early on in the film, it's quite easy to get irritated by Chihiro because she's always pulling on her parents. And even though, in essence, when they go into the magical realm, once they cross over the tunnel, she's right, you know, they should go. You know, she's forced into a situation where she's slowly having to mature and she's starting to have to take responsibility. I think that previous watches, not so much the one I'd done recently, but the previous watches I've done, maybe I think I saw a bit more of that. It's sort of happening there under the surface. It's not, you know, Miyazaki had to completely like flag up the fact that she is making these steps towards greater maturity. But I think you see it there. She becomes a more confident character. She becomes more capable. Yeah. But that's because she's probably surrounded by people who don't really cater to her making a fuss.
Exactly.
Like you said, I think it's interesting, the world is hostile to her, but not in a typical sense of, you know, like Lord of the Rings, for instance, they go into Mordor and people want to kill them, you know, whatever. It's just simply she's this othered thing, and the best thing they can probably think for her is that she needs to be eaten, you know, something like that.
Exactly.
By the end of the film, I do think that character has changed. She's not she's not the silly little girl. She's more aware. She's more helpful. I think when she goes to see Zeniba at the end of the film, she's doing things for her. She's a far more affectionate, less needy character.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think through what you were saying there about Haku and Chihiro. One of the things that she recognises, of course, is that he is the spirit of the river, and the river is something that saved her at one point. I was trying to wonder, in terms of what you were saying about a notion of love, there is something that grows in that bond between them that isn't, as you say, conventionally or Disney-esque romance, in the same way that I think what's nice about, if we, you know, ponder back to Mononoke, even though there's harmony by the end of the film, Mononoke still walks away saying, I don't know if I can forgive, but this is where we're at, we're at least a little bit further forward. And I think with Chihiro, I was just trying to think, there's something about her doing something for him without any need to have something returned. She's freed him, but ultimately I'm not sure that necessarily has sorted her problems out. There's something important for that character who has very early on been incredibly selfish. And I think also that one thing that stood out to me, the scene where No Face comes, and No Face is this very strange presence in the film, both in the sense of being very comforting, but also at the same time very disturbing, especially after the attack on the tower. And I was wondering with No Face whether it was, I guess, another manifestation of what she was doing very early on in the film. Not in the extreme way, but this was an extreme version of her, you know, constantly trying to consume, constantly trying to pull on her parents' time, on their love and so on. And that's what you know, he was constantly trying to do that at that point. And she obviously leads him away. And I think that's quite a pivotal moment for that particular character, for both of those characters. I mean, in the end, No Face, I think, ends up in Zeniba's cottage, and I don't know what he does from there. I think one of the things that does work about the film is you are curious about all these little elements, like where does Yubaba go, you know, at the end of the night when she flies off? Where does she go? Where do these spirits come from? What's happening in this world?
And it's seen almost this completely coexistent universe that humans never really have access to or see, even though they're not entirely unaware of the presence of humans. So that means that for them to know what a human is, they must have encountered them in so many ways before. It's just humans are not meant to be welcome within that space that they're in. Yeah, it's a really interesting one, because again, the world building is incredible, even though it's unstated. It's very much in the same spirit of Mononoke, where you're just thrown into it. This exists, this is happening, let's go. And it's really interesting. I mean, when you're talking about Haku versus Chihiro's relationship in terms of like the river spirits versus this child that nearly drowned, there's something about the fact that they had this bond that pre-existed, or that she was unaware of before they met again in the spirit world. But then also, besides the bond, which was just really the product of both of them having been in contact with each other at some point, where we could say that what Haku may have done for her as a child was completely out of, let's say, compassion. Somehow, by the end of the film, you realize that what exists between Chihiro and the river spirit has gone way beyond that. Mm. It's not just that, oh, you saved me one time and then I helped you this one time and, you know, I've paid back my debts or something. There's actually a real sense of, oh, I know the river spirit and the river spirit knows me and we have a thing. What that thing is isn't a rom-com thing, but it's a thing. And I'm just realizing how there is that thread that is going through to our final film that we're going to be discussing, which is M. Arrietty. So Arrietty, it's one of the Ghibli more recent classics that it's based around the Burrowers plot. in terms of, especially when we're comparing it to the two films that we've just talked about, in terms of like how intense those other ones are, Arrietty is very mellow. Like, it's so mellow. When I was watching it, I was like, oh my God, this is so chill. Thank God. I'm sorry, but like when a hog demon is coming out 5 minutes in and like vomiting blood worms, like, I'm sorry, like, I need quiet. What I remember about it the first time is, oh, that's really cool. Literally, I'm almost parroting what may have been a thought process. I was just like, that's really cool that Ghibli did this homage to The Borrowers, which was a book I quite enjoyed when I was a child. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was interesting that there was this fictional idea of little people that live in the world around us that take the things that we seem to have quote unquote misplaced and stuff like that. It was almost a weird of childish explanation for why I couldn't find my shoe. And Arrietty takes that premise and it follows one of such borrowers that exist in this house where this child has come to recover. And I feel almost like we've gone full circle because we have the whole element, like the convalescing character, which we had from My Neighbor Totoro, you know, that has gone out to like the countryside for maybe the clean air or something, even though, of course, I mean, he actually has a surgery upcoming. But, you know, you have this character who is unwell, who is obviously like a part of the plot. But I remember the first time I watched it just thinking, oh, it's cool that they made the story of borrowers from the perspective of one of them that was really so closely tied to how they were exploring this world that was much larger than them, but also the friendship that developed between her and the full-sized human that was there. And that's really what I remember. That I just thought that was really nice. I remember also being quite sad that by the end she had to leave, but it also just made sense for the plot. Like, she couldn't have stayed, really. Now that someone is out to get you, that's just not safe to be in. So how about you?
So I have to confess here, I had never seen Arrietty before watching it recently. Yeah. I think...
Which means we can just jump to what you think about it now.
Just to briefly say that this one didn't really come up on my radar at all. The last films I was aware of after Spirited Away was obviously Howl's Moving Castle, which was another strong contender for us to podcast.
Strong contender.
Perhaps we'll do another episode where we look at that.
Yeah.
Ponyo, and the only one I otherwise remember was The Wind Rises. And I think that...
Kiki's Delivery Service.
That came out in the 80s.
Come out in the 80s, that was quite an old one, yeah.
I was aware of the borrower's story.
Yeah.
I don't know if I ever read the book. I definitely remember it. But I think that what struck me about this was how well it could fit into this, as we've been talking about, this wider thematic around the natural world, the metaphysical world, and the human world.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that occurred to me, well, two other things. One, I think some of the sequences of the film are just stunning in the sense, you know, when she finally goes into the house and you just get that real sense of the scale of this human construction. And to certain sequences in it are really, you know, when she climbs up on the roof, she goes to the window, the scene where obviously she's seen in silhouette, and the relationship and how it's developing between these two. Like you said, this poor lonely boy who's clearly not very well, you know, another, I guess, motif of Miyazaki. And the other thing that occurred to me was just how the world itself was sort of stricken with this sadness. Like, they talk about there used to be other borrowers there, other families there, and they're walking through these old constructs and old lifts and whatever, thinking, this was probably made not by the father, but by this group who now they are the last ones that are there. Much like Nausicaa, much like Mononoke, there is a real fragility to this world that humans have impacted. And when the mad, I can't remember if she's the aunt or something like that, when she's going around like putting them into jars.
I think she's the maid.
The maid, yeah. You're just
I think she's the maid, yeah.
You can understand where humans become a bit obsessive and think it belongs to them. And it made me think of vivisection of people, butterflies in jars and stuff, and this idea of trying to contain that. I actually quite liked the resolution of the film, because I did think, oh, well, you know, there's all this talk about the doll's house and, oh, are they all going to end up living in the doll's house in harmony with the humans? And of course, it didn't really make much sense. Arrietty couldn't really make her family do that. And so even though it could be seen as unsatisfactory, because there's lots of setups to the idea that maybe they're going to end up in this doll's house, actually, no, they move because they have to, because they're trying to survive, you know?
Yeah. As much as I could understand how that might be disappointing on some level, I thought that, actually when I was watching the film and I felt that disappointment, I had this reflection on it. As much as that might be disappointing to me, I am still looking at this from the perspective of a human. And that is almost central to what the conflict is in the film, because you have this other set of human-like beings who are small people, but they have an entirely different world that they live in. They have an entirely different life. I mean, the first thing that I found really fascinating, especially when we're comparing Spirited Away to Arrietty, right? What I found really interesting is that how, from the perspective of Arrietty, the human world is the magical one. From Arrietty's perspective, what we see as everyday and normal is actually massive, fantastical, epic, incredible, grand. And I think there's a flipping of the script that Arrietty provides in terms of its narrative structure, because usually we start the film from the perspective of a human or humanish character which gets to encounter the supernatural. But then in the case of Arrietty, sometimes it feels almost the human world is the supernatural.
Yes, yeah, because absolutely.
Then you have these massive giant creatures that you live alongside, which shape much of the world around you the same way, let's say, a forest spirit might. But you also don't really have much control over what they can do to you and the power that they wield. And so in a sense, I found like Arrietty to be almost queering the human space, thinking about how we human beings are so impactful on the world around them, for good and for bad. Because of course, like the main character here, like the sick boy, actually becomes quite a force for good in her life. So it's almost like how Haku in Spirited Away was a river spirit, but was a force for good for the human character within this massive world where she felt really, really powerless and unable to do much. And for me, that's where I was making the parallels between the two films. But also that relationship that happens between two entities from two different worlds existing at two different scales in different speeds, and bond that is formed there, which is a sort of love bond, but it's not the love bond that, of course, we are used to in Western romanticism, where everything ends up in you are my everything and let's have sex at some point. I can't even, I just really want to like...
Procreate.
Let's procreate for the sake of capitalism. But the point that this got to ultimately by the end of it was more of a sense of harmonious resolution for both of us. And we have been involved in each other's lives in beneficial ways. And I think that's really what the love is. That is at the center of it. It's being able to take on someone else's interest as your own without much else to that. So I think that is this love that comes through in all these films that I'm seeing. But then all that set up for how the dollhouse was actually made for the borrowers who thought it was made for dolls, which was the irony of it.
Yeah.
Someone actually made this house for them, but they thought it was just made for something else, which means that they almost never saw it as, okay, this was actually made for us. Like everything was to their scale and they could have lived there really comfortably. But the thing is that living there comfortably would have meant living on somebody else's terms.
Yes.
Which I think was what they had to get away from. Because if they did, in fact, live in the dollhouse, that just means, one, the humans know exactly where they are, can gain access to them whenever they want. Secondly, as much as they are living in this house that has been made for them, I can't escape the feeling that they would have felt that they were somehow indebted to the humans for providing such a fantastic space for them and all of that. And all of this is, for me, is evidenced by the point where the boy effectively tries to force the kitchen on them. Because for him to give them the kitchen, he literally rips the roof off the house and rips the kitchen that they have already and puts the one that they've made that is nice and shiny and beautiful. And the mother likes it and she's like, oh my God, this is the kitchen I have always dreamed of. But the way in which she gets it is not really on her terms. It's not really with her consent. Here is the thing that we've made for you that is better for you. I'm going to give it to you. And I feel that power differential would always have existed if they ever tried to live in the house that the humans made. And so the freedom that they gained for themselves, in spite of the fact that they had to leave behind this fantastic thing that would have made their lives probably so much better in a quote-unquote objective sense, but the fact that they had to leave that behind for their true freedom to face the wild, to face the unknown, to go out into the wider world and deal with whatever that might be, including predators like cats or raccoons or whatever else might be out there. At least that might be more dangerous, but it's on their terms. They could be safe with the humans in this house that was made for them, or they could live free on their terms and possibly die free. And I feel like that was how the film was resolved, which I appreciate now. Even though, of course, there was a part of me that deep down was disappointed. Oh my God, you could have lived in the fantastic big mansion that was literally made for you. Think of how expensive it must have been to have a toy maker custom make a house for borrowers, not even for dolls. Mm. But that's still thinking about it from in terms of like human concerns here. But if I want to think about it from the perspective of what are the borrowers' concerns, then obviously my mindset has to shift.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of the point.
And I think that's probably truer to each of the films that we've talked about today. To have them move into that house, yes, you could say there's a quasi-harmony there, but actually it undermines the message that both parties have to have some level of freedom here, freedom to forgive, freedom to move, freedom to think about the other in that situation. And I think that them being stuck in the house would have been to deny that, because for exactly the reasons that you said, it's not really freedom. It's living under the terms of the human beings. And also, one of the things that was nice about the borrowers is that they had managed to create their own little world, with this mixture itself of human objects and natural objects out of the sight of humans. You know, it had some level of privacy to it, and their own enclosed little place. And the idea of always being on the display of human beings' little house, I think there's something quite unnerving about that. It sort of made me think of the stories, obviously, that had been told about the little people, about the borrowers.
Yeah.
That for humans, that's what the wild means. It means that you don't have control. You just have a part to play in the wild, but you can't be the person who has ownership of it or can have it at your whim. And I think this is something that, again, we go back through the films and even the other films that we haven't fully talked about. It's that quality of hubris of human beings that keeps reoccurring quite powerfully across the films. And I think to have resolved it in, again, a more quote-unquote conventional way would have been incredibly problematic to, you know, Miyazaki's work. Like yourself, and I love that turning it around, that the human world becomes the mystical fantasy place, unlike the previous ones. I think it makes for a nice one to end on, because we started with Totoro and also thinking about Mononoke, but if you were to go back to Nausicaa, which is just such a disturbing beauty to that film, to come to this film where it's the opposite, where the human world has that sense of it's familiar, but it's also eerie and, you know, dangerous. I think, it's a nice way to bookend it, I think.
Yeah. I think looking at the entire canon, if I were to just round up my thoughts about it, what I have gained from watching these films, as well as reflecting on the other films that I've seen, which we haven't talked about, things like Howl's Moving Castle, Porco Rosso, The Wind Also Rises. There are so many films by Miyazaki. I feel like what is always really interesting is how the human themes, the emotional themes, the meta story, the story behind the story. I feel that is always the interesting thing to unpack when you're done. So it doesn't just give you simple, straightforward narratives. It doesn't give you Disney-esque plot lines where it's like, okay, this person is good guy, this person is bad guy. There is a hero's journey that centers one character, and then by the time you get to the end of it, like, everything is nicely tied up and resolved, and all's well that ends well. It normally is, it might end on a good-ish note, but there's always this sense of there was more that came before it and there's more that's happening after it, and we've only just been witness to the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the common feeling I got with every single film. It always felt I just watched the middle or something that tells me something about these people and might change the futures that they might have, but it's never going to give me the entire story. I'll never get any sense of closure. And I have to be comfortable with that. I may not have an entire sense of closure. I may just have a sense of this very specific conflict that we focused on has ended. But there's so much happening before. There's so much happening after. And that's fine. You know, for instance, like in My Neighbor, Totoro, it gets to the end. We don't know what the relationship between them and Totoro might continue to be. Will they continue to have access to the spiritual world even as they get older? Will they fall out of it? Will they no longer be able to see the dust bunnies and things like that? There's all of that that we really don't know, and we just leave it there, you know. Or with Princess Mononoke, she goes back to the forest, she goes back to the human world. They said that they're going to rebuild. Are they going to rebuild better, repeat the same mistakes that they did before, and make something that is even more exploitative? We don't know. It's just what it is. What about the fact that the forest spirit is now somehow quote-unquote gone? Has it really gone, or has it just retreated in such a way that it's no longer accessible to humans, given what the humans just did? What does this mean for the nature of the forest? Again, we don't know. It just leaves us there.
Yeah.
But that's the beauty of Miyazaki films. It does that with confidence. It doesn't pretend to tie everything up nicely.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I don't feel like that does justice to what the films are meant to do. That is the spirit of Miyazaki in any way.
I agree. I think that, especially when we look at these films, sometimes it's a nudge or sometimes it's a bit of a jab about our relationship with the metaphysical, the natural world, the unknown uncertainties in life.
And it suggests other.
And each other, and suggests trying to find some degree of acceptance or reciprocity, some kind of harmony. But I think he acknowledges across these films and the other ones, like you said, we haven't talked about, that's not necessarily the end point. It doesn't all end with the violins playing and the sun goes down and blah, blah, blah. Actually, there are various complexities. I even like the end of Mononoke, when the final bit of it is the guy who's basically been the grifter, the con man, he just turns around, to hell with you guys. You know,
exactly.
He hasn't really understood what has happened, because usually a character like that would be killed off. You don't get it. Okay,
our satisfaction, you know.
Yeah. Where actually he just carries on, but we are looking at him now as this. The reason you don't get it is because you don't have that appreciation. But life will carry on for you, and you imagine he's just going to go and do exactly the same thing until he eventually gets killed by either a giant wolf or a pig or another human being.
Yeah.
So it's an element which I can imagine for some viewers, especially if you're looking for resolution, if you're looking for what we were talking about before with Chicken Run, where the things that are set up, everything's paid off, everything's nicely comes together. Fairy tales always having the sense of a happy resolution. It's not really what Miyazaki does. I think they always end in a very optimistic, uplifting way.
But that's the thing about it that I love. Like, I love that it ends with optimism, but not finality.
Yes,
And that's where I will stop talking. So thank you so much.
Yeah. I would just briefly say, because I don't know whether we will go on to do an episode on it, the recent Miyazaki film.
Yes, latest, The Boy and the Heron.
Boy and the Heron.
Yeah.
I think one thing I will say, this is definitely the most fever dream of his films, to the extent that I've just been calling it The Boy on Heroin.
Well, it is possible that I will see it this week.
Oh, so, okay. So we can
put a pin in that. We might be able to talk about this by maybe next week. Hopefully.
Okay, cool.
I just hope it
That'd
all works
awesome.
Out. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you
for engaging with our brain farts. And we will see you on the next episode.
Yes.
All right.
Bye.
Bye, I guess. Bye. This is not the end. This is just and into. Okay, I'm going to stop now. Bye.